Chapter 36, The Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Chloe and I put behind the trauma of our time in jail, and in the 2 months before our marriage, we were happier than we had ever been. I stored my files and papers at my family's house at the lakefront, sold my car, and we drove down together in Chloe's car to be married in West Palm Beach. My good friend, Rayleigh Hart, came down to our wedding, held in the West Palm Beach Presbyterian Church. Chloe sewed her own wedding dress and made a beautiful bride. It was a simple wedding with a non-alcoholic party afterward in the church reception hall. Chloe and I decided that we needed to get as far away from minority-controlled New Orleans as we could, and decided to visit my sister for a while in the very European-American Seattle area. We planned to stay with her a while, find work, and either complete my college education there or go back to LSU. The drive to Seattle was to be our honeymoon, but we decided to spend the first day of our honeymoon near Key West, camping on one of the many small islands we could sail to on Chloe's small sunfish sailboat. The plan was that after a couple days of sailing and camping, we'd return to Palm Beach, drop off the boat, and begin our long trip to Seattle. We'd travel from the very tip of the southeasternmost point of the continental United States to nearly the most northwestern point. We arrived near Key West in the late afternoon, loaded the sailboat, and headed out in the shallow lagoons looking for a hospitable sandy beach island. After about 3 hours, and too far from our car to return that night, we still hadn't found a suitable spot. All the little islands shown on the marine maps turned out to be simply thick groves of mangrove roots coming directly out of the shallow water. We couldn't find a clear beach anywhere. Finally, we found the little island with no beach, but it did have an old dock with a small doorless hut the size of an oversized telephone booth, occupied by an empty old wooden cable spool laying on its side and filling the enclosure. The sun was low, so we decided to stay for the night on the old dock, which was only about 2 feet wide and about 15 feet long. We put out a blanket and quickly shed our clothes, anxious to get into the emerald water. We dove into the clear water, and after a few minutes were reclining on the blanket watching a glowing orange sun merge with the ocean horizon, happy to be with each other. As the dusk faded, I kissed her. Suddenly, she broke away from my lips and said, "Ouch!" Just as I was about to say, "What did I do?" an ouch blurted my own throat. A bloodthirsty swarm of mosquitoes had descended upon us. And I thought these beasts worse than any I'd ever experienced in Louisiana's darkest swamps. Luckily, we had some repellent, but the infernal creatures still managed to find an unprotected spot here and there, even if it meant penetrating some clothing. After using about half the bottle of repellent, we seemed to have the mosquito problem under control. But just before the light was completely gone, Chloe motioned to me that there were eyes staring at us from the mangroves. I thought she must be imagining them, but when I turned to look, I could see little pairs of eyes catching the remaining light. They were the eyes of rats. Then we saw it. A rat the size of a dachshund crept up the dock toward us, showing no fear of us and no respect for us as a honeymoon couple. Others had congregated on the far end of the dock as they were soldiers assembling for a military operation. I threw a few shells at them and they scurried away, but they remained at the edge of the mangroves, waiting for their opportunity. We saw their eyes glowing like red coals until the dusk turned into an inky darkness that extinguished their color. I shined my flashlight up the dock, inspecting it plank by plank until I could see dozens of glowing eyes peering at us from the darkness. So far, our wedding night had been something less than blissful. Still, we made the best of it. We stayed alert, and I kept a supply of shells nearby to keep the rats at bay. At about 10 p.m., the wind picked up and a thunderstorm bubbled up from the warm, watered gulf side of the island. The dock had not been big enough for us to set up our pup tent, so when the bone-chilling rain came, it soaked our bedding and clothes. Lightning flashed down, streak after streak, while we remained exposed at the end of the dock. Every bolt illuminated the ragtag troop of rats that lurked at the dock's edge, looking for a meal. In the worst of the downpour, we grabbed our things and headed for the shack. Rats or no rats. We could have fit within the wooden rims of the empty spool turned on its side and thus been sheltered completely from the rain, but we did not want to be down on the floor with rats, which by that time had sought their own shelter there. A 6-inch diameter metal pipe ran from the hollow axis of the spool on the floor up through the roof. We sat on top of the spool, still getting wet from the hole in the ceiling through which the metal pipe protruded well beyond the roof line. We huddled as close as we could, the rusty metal pipe between us, the rain dripping on our heads, and the lightning crashing all around. It occurred to us that the metal pipe amounted to a lightning rod that would likely end our marriage before our honeymoon ended, but we resolved to stay where we were, come what may. In the morning, worn out and sleepless, we saw that the bright sun had banished the rats and mosquitoes back into the mangroves. So we stretched out on the dock and dried out. Chloe scraped up some breakfast while I fished unsuccessfully, and then we decided to see if we could find a better island. If not, we would get back to the car and return to Palm Beach. We had enough of that island paradise. We found nothing suitable and sailed in the direction of Highway 1, where we had parked the car. About 1 p.m., we found our small boat being escorted by two nice-sized sharks, occasionally cutting the shallow, crystal-clear water with their oily-looking gray dorsals. We had difficulty maneuvering in the shallow reef water and had to raise the centerboard about halfway. Then a really fierce afternoon thunderstorm approached us from the south. We had never seen a sky exactly that color, a deep, deep purple. The wind and waves and rain buffeted us terribly as we lowered the sail and tried to keep the small boat into the wind as best we could. We couldn't lower the centerboard all the way because of the coral, and the boat was unstable in the wind and waves with the centerboard half up. In our frazzled state of mind, we were sure that if we capsized, the sharks would satisfy their appetites. Chloe began to cry, but we hung on until the storm had passed. Our boat, with its scarred centerboard and damaged sail, finally made it in. We warily loaded it onto the trailer and headed for West Palm Beach. It had been a memorable 24-hour honeymoon. We stayed another night in West Palm Beach, and then with less than $200, we set off for Seattle. Of course, one could go a long way on $200 in a compact car when gasoline cost 35 cents a gallon. Still, to make it on that money, we had to camp out all the way, sleep in our pup tent, and cook our food using Sterno. We visited Yellowstone and Glacier National Parks. In Yellowstone, in our small pup tent, we awoke shivering as a 6-inch layer of snow had blanketed us. Our car had no heater. It was a South Florida car. Despite our limited budget, we went to the park cafeteria that morning and had our first restaurant meal on the trip, bowls of hot oatmeal, 2 cups of hot coffee, and a wonderful respite by the brick fireplace. We arrived at Glacier National Park right after they reopened the Going to the Sun Highway following an early snowstorm. The mountains were beautiful in their early white dusting. I told Chloe that they'd put on their white wedding dress just for us. We finally arrived at my sister and brother-in-law's house in mid-September. We were broke, tired, and ready to find work. In less than a week, we both found employment at the SeaTac Motor Inn in Federal Way, Washington, and we found a dingy, rent-by-the-week room at a motel. I put in for a job offering at Boeing Aircraft, and we decided that if it came through, we would remain in the Northwest, and I would complete my degree at the University of Washington. I did not get the job, so we decided to make as much money as possible at SeaTac and save every possible penny so that I could attend LSU in the spring semester. To do that, we had to work double shifts. I bellhopped and bussed tables, and Chloe waitressed for hotel functions. With her college degree in home economics education, Chloe was soon managing the waitresses and setups for the scheduled events. Many days we worked 16 hours, but we knew we were working for the future. Even though I still read a number of books a week, the long, mindless hours on the job gave me a chance to think about the cause and the best way to spread the truth. Jim Lindsay wrote me a few times from New Orleans and urged me to become active in the Klan again. He sent me some books on Nathan Bedford Forrest and some excellent material he had written about the original Klan being the first successful racial movement in history. As for me, I had my racial worldview, but I needed guidance on the vehicle that could be built to take that ideology to victory. I concentrated my reading on the histories of revolutionary movements. I read books on the American and French revolutions. I also studied the communist movement, Nazism, and the fascist movements of Mussolini and Sir Oswald Mosley. I looked into the political movements of populist Huey Long of Louisiana and William Jennings Bryan. I also looked at the dynamics of religious movements and even the principles by which commercial enterprises are successfully organized. It seemed that all I thought about during my days at work and my reading at home was the creation of a movement that could wake up our people and organize them for political victory. On a Friday in late October, I had worked a 16-hour double shift, during which time I turned over and over in my mind how I could best serve the movement. That evening, I fell into a restless sleep, Chloe by my side. At 6 a.m., I woke up completely alert and resolved. I knew exactly what I would do. My plan was laid out in my mind for the years ahead. As of the fall of 1972, Klan groups around America had dwindled to shadows of what they once were. I contacted Jim Lindsay and proposed that we completely modernize the Klan. My concept did not mean that we would moderate its beliefs, but that we would deepen them with greater racial and scientific understanding. We would build upon the traditions that create a modern social movement. To me, that meant building the Klan into a political machine to change men's minds. It meant focusing on the young and the next generation while still venerating the old Klan traditions. And it meant the full rights of women to participate in the struggle for the survival of themselves and their children and families. It would be a literate Klan that would meet in the hotel conference rooms as well as in the farmers' fields, the big cities as well as the villages, and the colleges as well as the factories. The Klan had to be recreated like the original movement led by knowledgeable and honorable men, and this was my vision. I called James Lindsay and asked him a simple question. Would he let me modernize the Klan from top to bottom? Would I let you? He responded. I want you to do this more than anything in the world. In his typically dramatic way of saying things, he told me, you know, it's your destiny to do this. For the next few weeks, I worked days at the hotel and nights at the apartment, completely rewriting the program and policies of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. I adopted the more modern version of the symbol and redesigned the publications, often conferring with Jim by telephone. Chloe and I finally left Federal Way in November. We went straight down the west coast to San Francisco. We drove around the University of California campus at Berkeley and were shocked by the brazenly communist posters that seemed to have been posted on every telephone pole. The open promotion of homosexuality also surprised and disgusted us. We knew that the rest of the country was just a bit behind Berkeley. Was this what we could expect soon back home. Then we set off to the redwoods of the giant forest, a place I'd always wanted to visit again since I read the writings of Madison Grant, the white racialist who was the American most responsible for the preservation of these magnificent trees. It was interesting to me that I was drawn to his conservation work long before I knew of his devotion to also preserving the beauty of Western mankind. Walking beneath the redwood behemoths, one realizes how small and short-lived a single human being is in the natural scheme of things. It really brought home to me our subservience to nature and her laws. Our next stop was the Grand Canyon. We tied our sleeping bags to our backs, packed some food, and began a hike down to the Colorado River. At the south rim, the snow was 2 feet thick. Halfway down, the trail turned to mud, and the rest of the way had temperatures that were mild, and the weather was beautiful. Over the years, I've returned to the canyon at least a dozen times. Every time I approach the south rim after a long absence, I'm so overwhelmed by its beauty that I find it difficult to speak for a while. Seeing the carving of the river into the magnificent canyon is like opening a great encyclopedia of the Earth's history. To me, such a place is more beautiful than any man-made temple and a more eloquent expression of God's word than any written form. We also stopped off in Flagstaff and paid homage to my aunt and uncle, Mildred and Wally Hatcher. We did so at the memorial to those who had died in the great air collision over the canyon. The last important stop on our way back was San Antonio. Seeing the Alamo for the first time since becoming racially aware had a powerful impact on both Chloe and me. The men who had fought and died there had their origins in almost every nation of Europe. They gave their lives so that people of our heritage could live in freedom across this entire continent. Their sacrifice not only inspired the Americans to victory against the Mexicans and Santa Anna at San Jacinto, but should inspire every European for as long as our genotype lives. To see the prostitutes, drug dealers, and other lowlife tolerated just outside the walls of this monument made me realize how tragically far and fast our people had descended. It made me anxious to begin my political work again, and I think I drove a bit faster than usual all the way back to Louisiana. Chloe and I settled in Baton Rouge, and I re-enrolled at LSU. I was a ball of energy, filling my days and nights with study and activity. I began organizing and building the largest Klan unit in the nation in Baton Rouge and at LSU, and I established 22 other new dens in Louisiana and Mississippi. Chloe and I also opened a successful daycare center at Woodlawn Baptist Church in the eastern section of Baton Rouge. I took heavy academic loads of 18 to 21 semester credit hours, and I began traveling on weekends, organizing the Klan far beyond our two main states of Mississippi and Louisiana. As my work for the Klan became more successful, Lindsay appointed me as Grand Dragon of Louisiana and also the National Information Director of the organization. The Klan began to rise again. The next chapter is chapter 37, The Klan Rises.